The last case on our docket today is in the matter of the guardianship of the person in the estate of Aidan Helu, an adult, Fanuel, I hope I pronounced that correctly, Gabrius, appellant versus Primary Healthcare Services, LLC, DBA, St. Mary's Regional Medical Center, case number 68531. I appreciate counsel's availability on an expedited basis to try to address this case and the sad facts surrounding it. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. O'Meara?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Hardesty, Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court. May it please the Court, my name is David O'Meara, and I represent Mr. DeBreyes, who is the guardian of Aidan, who is the subject of this appeal. I reserve 6 minutes for my rebuttal in this case.
I know we're not supposed to go outside the record, but under the unusual circumstances of this case, could counsel advise the court as to the current status of Ms. Helu?
The current status is the same status. There hasn't been any change as far as we know.
Still at St. Mary's.
That's correct. She is still at St. Mary's, and St. Mary's has allowed for us to move forward on this expedited basis.
Okay.
Other than the dispute in regards to whether or not she's getting the proper care is not a part of the record.
Okay. Go ahead.
The court is well aware of the facts of this case, and today we really are here on an issue of a matter of life and death. We're here for the first time really to determine the standards and the obligations of those who are called upon to make a determination of the Uniform Determination of Death Act. And as the court is aware, this act requires that a person's entire brain, including her brainstem, must cease to function before death can be determined. Now, this act requires medical professionals to apply accepted medical standards, which will also result in a decision that is uniform throughout the entire United States, not just here in Nevada. And it appears from the beginning of this case that...
So, I wasn't going to interrupt, but you said uniform throughout the United States. And looking at this material, that was the first thing that came into play. It doesn't seem to be uniform. The scale, there's some factors out there, but how it's applied is still not uniform, and that's part of the dilemma we have here.
Are you saying that there are case law, there are certain things that...
That seems to be the problem with the case law. We have some states that have gone this way, some others that have gone this way. The AMA, we have the Harvard situation, we have some other findings in between.
Right, and I think that the supplemental appendix in regards to New Jersey brings out a lot of things in regards to the ANA being additional research must be required for the ANA standards and protocols that we believe are just educational and not actually locked in stone standards under the literature that has been presented by the ANA. But what we have to look at first in this case is the statute and what the plain language of the statute requires. And the plain language of the statute requires that all brain functions cease to exist. That's all. So if we have, in any circumstance, an ability to say that all brain functions have not ceased to exist, to function, then we cannot determine brain death. And that is what the issue is really here in this case, because we have a mechanism that was utilized in this case. In fact, as I was starting my presentation, it was the doctors at St. Mary's who specifically directed EEG testing to occur. And now they're saying those tests are not applicable, even though we found that brain waves and brain functioning was existence. We're going to go ahead and just not use those criteria and find a different criteria to go about.
Was there one or two? Because that there seemed a little confusion in the record in terms of there was one done, then there seemed to be some confusion whether a second set were done.
In fact, there wasn't just one or two. There was actually three EEGs that were performed. Those will be shown through the documents on page 561, 560, 560, in those general area of the appendix. And you look at Dr. Hyde's notes, and he specifically says, I'm directing these EEG tests, and then depending upon those results, I'll determine what happens. Well, he gets brain waves, and then just under the record just shows that nothing is done in regards to that. So while we have a statute that specifically says you have to have the cessation of all brain functions, including the brain stem, the criteria or the test performed by the doctor, which shows that that is not in existence, they just basically throw that away and say, we're going to go ahead and use different criteria. And the case law throughout the entire country, when we look at what happens, okay, we look at the history of whether EEG tests are performed, and the ANA is not required to do it, but still, to this day, EEGs are performed, even though they're so-called not required by the ANA, which is the standard set that is argued by St. Mary's. And it's not shown by just the case law. It's shown by their own actions. If it wasn't required, why did they perform them in the first place? Because that is the standard in which the United States and all of our case law shows that we would go beyond, we take whatever technological advances that we have out there in this country to make sure, beyond a doubt, that there is brain death. And when you look at what the literature came in the supplemental briefing, the supplemental appendix, and they talk about what the Act was for. It was for ensuring accuracy in such an irreversible declaration, securing equitable treatment under the law, and allaying public suspicion and misunderstanding about BD death, which is brain dead death. What suspicions and misunderstandings do we present when the court just says you have a test that confirms that there is no brain death, but you can throw that away because you, as a doctor, has determined that there is no functional ability of her coming back from where she is, and therefore she is dead? The public would never believe in brain death. If tests done by doctors are just forgotten, we don't even have to deal with them anymore. We'll just go do a different test. And that's something that we have to avoid and should have been avoided in this case. When we look at the history, and we have April 1st. We have, according to the St. Mary's, an alive individual. We go all the way through April 15th, and we still have an alive individual because we have EEG tests. Then only until May do we finally get a determination of death.
Has there been any EEG tests after April?
Not to my knowledge. In fact, there were no EEG tests after the April 16th date. And so there was prior to the court making a determination, and I don't believe there has been anything since that time.
And the EEG test is, correct me if I'm wrong here, I don't know whether I'm right or wrong. So is the EEG test a part of the so-called Harvard criteria but not the ANA?
So the Harvard criteria came out in 1968. And in 1968, the Harvard criteria specifically said two EEG tests within a 24-hour period.
That were flatline.
That were flat. That's correct, 24-hour. And doctors throughout, and you can look through the case law that we have in regards to what doctors did. And a lot of the case law in between 1968 through 1980.
And has Harvard changed those criteria?
So by the 1980s, that criteria was taken out in regards to the 24-hour period. But neurologists throughout the United States still have that criteria. And there's a case in Ohio, the 1983 case, which was cited in our brief, which is after the Harvard study had kind of changed their position in that regard, and they still determined they still needed two EEG tests within a 24-hour period because that's what neurologists wanted to do. And throughout that entire period, we still look at what neurologists and other physicians, in this case, we're kind of fixated on neurology in this case, which is not the law. A neurologist does not need to be, under the law, the person making the brain death. And in fact, some of the case law has just normal physicians that understand what the parameters are. But what happened is that we have those cases in throughout the country that still, even after there has been some change, still require an EEG test. So we have the California case where basically the court says, which is the conservatorship of Drabik, says, if you're not flat, you're not dead. That's pretty clear, that if you're not flat, because the statute is clear. There's the plain language.
What's the source of that? I mean, I guess we have a statute that says accepted medical standards, correct?
That's correct.
And another section talks about irreversible cessation, and it's a very all-inclusive statute, all brain function,
right.
All STEM. Are there other courts that have said we're not going to do the AN standards because they're not accepted? Is that an expert determination? Is that a legal determination?
Well, I think it's both. I think that the courts have kind of looked at it as the standards have to be applicable to the statute. And so what we're saying is that, and it's interesting, St. Mary's wants us to do a bright line ANA standard, saying these are the rules
right. And
this is how it is. But then when Mr. Jabari says, well, wait a second, we need to have a rule that says if you have a EEG that says not flatline, you can't have an EEG. So at one point they want strict compliance with the ANA, and then when we want strict compliance of what the national neurologists throughout the country through case law have shown, that's not acceptable. So what you have to do first is we have to look at the statute, which says that you have to have all functioning, all cessation of all functions. So you have to look at what standards are put into place that say all functions through a national mechanism. So under that standard, the ANA does not satisfy the standard because if you do take a test, if you do an EEG, and you find brain function, and that's not required, then you have evidence showing that it doesn't meet the standard under the law.
Let me ask you this. If another EEG were performed and it were flat, would that be the end of your case at that point?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
I think that, there's...
I don't mean to be hard on you. I
understand. And that certainly would be a detriment to my client. It would be another factor in which the court would determine. And if you look at what the case law says, is that they normally look at the EEG, and if it's flat, then they've gone on to different protocols in regards to that. And then we move forward.
So you see it as a threshold to cross,
right.
not the final?
Yeah, I can't say it for a certainty, because here's the problem that you incur when we go back after she's been laying in the bed for since April, and St. Mary's has said that they cannot perform any type of therapy, which is one of the arguments that we made in the lower court was we need thyroid therapy, which will help her brain function, which will help her brain heal itself. And I know I'm in my rebuttal, but that's a problem that we're going to have when we go back, because you have to have at least a flat EEG throughout the system when you move forward and when you take the test. And when you look at that, the Stranchan case in New Jersey, it specifically says in the dissent that when you utilize an EEG, it has to be flat. That's page 332 in that case. It has to be flat if you utilize that. So we have to use all mechanisms. That's the whole reason we have this case, is to use the technology that we have to not only confirm, but to make that determination with all of the assets that we have as a society. And in this case, we did not do that. And what we will ask the court to find that the court did not apply the proper standards, and therefore the determination of death was improper. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Romero. Mr. Peterson.
First of all, members of the court, on behalf of St. Mary's Hospital, many of whom are sitting here in the front row, I want to express our appreciation for the expedited way in which the court is handling this case, as we have requested. We know that the court is extremely congested and busy, and again, this case has only been pending for 2 months, and we very much appreciate the opportunity that you've given us to get here as quickly as you can. And as I've already indicated, sitting in the front row here are really the members of the staff, the professional staff at St. Mary's, that have been taking care of Aiden Halu since April 1st of 2015, when she went into a coma up until today, including the chief executive officer of St. Mary's, who sits closest to the aisle here, who has been involved in this case also personally from the beginning. If you're familiar with the record, has also testified in the court and from the witness stand graciously offered to Mr. Halu the opportunity, even after Aiden Halu was declared brain dead, to have another neurologist come in and do whatever tests they wanted to do, to make whatever arrangements they could make, to transport Aiden to another facility, again, on the presumption that such physician could give orders on the belief or based upon a clinical determination that Aiden Halu was, in fact, alive and not dead. And, of course, that did not happen.
What stops the transport back to Las Vegas?
Your Honor, this case actually commenced. I'm not sure it's fully explicated in the record, but it started with Judge Steinheimer on an emergency motion brought by Kelvin Dunlap, who was the first counsel for the family. After about 2 hours of hearing, at that point in time, the hospital Ms. Lindholm, as the CEO, made a proposal that was conformed and put into the form of a stipulation and an order of the court that allowed the family for a period of 3 weeks to find another neurologist to contradict the clinical determination of death by St. Mary's Hospital. There was a period of time in which they were going to do that. They identified a doctor from Stanford to do that. That did not occur within the requisite period of time, although they did retain a doctor. That was Dr. Gomez. That's it. This is in the record, who is not a neurologist but did come into the hospital during the period of time that Mr. Dunlap was representing the family. He did conduct what is the acid test for brain death, which is called an apnea test. He did it over the objection, apparently, of the family, but nonetheless did it, the apnea test, which basically is a disconnection of the ventilator from the patient to determine whether the patient will draw a breath. Does not result in death because oxygen is administered to the patient such that they will not die from oxygen deprivation during the course of the test. But the purpose of it basically is because of the buildup of carbon dioxide, because they are not exhaling, indicating brain death. That is the acid test that was conducted by a doctor retained by the family. She failed the apnea test. She was declared brain dead. The doctor disclosed in the medical record that this is unequivocal indication of brain death. No further confirmatory tests need to be done. However, then they retained a doctor who was, I've indicated in the record somewhat, in my view, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but, on the fringe of medicine, not a neurologist, who indicated that based upon this EEG that Justice Pickering was talking about that I'd like to speak about in a moment, indicated some brain activity. That was enough for Judge Steinheimer to send it back to Judge Doherty, who is the judge of the guardianship court for the proceedings.
Why isn't it up to the family as to whether to take somebody off a ventilator? I've been a lawyer since 1970. I was a district court judge for 8 years, and I've been here 9 years. And I always thought it was up to the family. Even if you're brain dead, they've declared brain dead, that there's always the hope that something can happen.
No, actually, it is precisely the opposite, Your Honor. It is precisely for the reason that you've identified that the law prescribes. It's not up to the family to make this determination. And the reason why it's not up to the family is because a determination of death is a legal status, and it has implications not just for the family, but for society as a whole, for other family members, for the hospital, which is why we have adopted the Uniform Act, precisely for that reason, because it would never be, almost never be the situation where a family, well, I should say never, but very rarely, clearly there'd be a reluctance on the part of the family to disconnect the ventilator. That's why this law was enacted, to prevent those decisions from being made by the family. The statute specifically says the determination of death is made on the basis of acceptable medical standards, which is what happened here.
And why do you have to put do not resuscitate in the living wills, like for our seniors, like I did for my mom before she passed, with do not resuscitate? In other words, When people went down the living wills. If
what you're talking about there, Your Honor, and what you're talking about there is Chapter 449 of the NRS as opposed to 450. Chapter 449 of the NRS deals precisely with your situation. And in fact, I pulled the statute out because I anticipated somebody might ask.
I don't mean to be, but I'm real naive on this subject, and I want to make sure that whatever I decide in this case, that it's good in my heart, too, besides the law.
The important point, if nothing else is taken away from my argument, the important point I wish to have the court understand and distinguish, and it is in fact an ambiguity that was identified in the drafters of the Uniform Act, trying to distinguish between life-sustaining treatment for someone who is alive and for which such treatment is helpful as opposed to someone who is dead. In Chapter 449 of the NRS, there is a whole section in there about persons who are not clinically dead but are alive and what is the moral, ethical, and legal obligations to keep such person who is not dead. They're in the process of dying, but they're not dead. What are the obligations, legal obligations, to go forward and continue that form of treatment? What rights does the patient have or does the family have in that context, which is not this context, in that context to say no resuscitation? The statute sort of makes it clear, Your Honor. It says, and I read from 449 now. This is the area that you're inquiring into. Life-sustaining treatment means a medical procedure or intervention that, when administered to a patient, serves only to prolong the process of dying. And then that whole chapter goes on to discuss, you know, what rights and remedies are associated with that particular situation, that context, which is not this context, Your Honor. Our context is in Chapter 450, which is startlingly entitled Dead Bodies. That is the name of the particular chapter that we're dealing with. And it begins with the Uniform Act.
And, Mr. Peterson, as to that Uniform Act, it seems that, at least from my reading, that the Uniform Act is a little broader than the AAN, just slightly.
Again,
that's my concern, and
it was. And I was.
I've gone through this. I see they attempted to perform the tests that required by the AAN, but the Uniform Act seems to say medically accepted, so to speak. In my parlance, it's not correct terminology, but so we come down to this EEG. Why we have this battle between the AAN and what appears to be the language that our state has adopted, the UDDA.
All right. And I think that goes to what Justice Pickering was concerned about as well. These questions, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, are basically spoken to by the drafters of the statute because they feared that courts would intervene, and the doctors feared that the courts would intervene in the process of making the determination of brain death, which is why the statute was very deliberately written in a very broad way to say that the determination of death is made, and the rest of it, under accepted medical standards. The predecessor
statute. But it also specifies, I understand that, and that's an interesting legal question about is that expert, is that, you know, who populates accepted medical standards? Do the courts, do the medical community, is it religious, is it ethical, what is it? But the statute that's giving me pause is 451.0071B, which speaks in terms of irreversible cessation of all functions of the person's entire brain, including his or her brain stem. And I'm struggling to understand whether the AN tests meet that or whether
they do.
Tell me why an EEG is not part of that calculus.
I will tell you why. First, it's the American Academy of Neurology.
Yeah.
The American Academy of Neurology has specified a very particular test to be run, and it basically consists in three parts. Is there a coma? Is it persistent? Is it going to be irreversible, do you think? That basically is an examination of the records.
But number does two, that equal irreversible cessation of all functions
right.
of entire
that's
brain?
Right. Which is a clinical which, Your Honor, is a clinical determination. And by clinical, I mean it is a doctor performing tests of functions, of brain functions. And therefore, the standard, which is, despite what counsel says, the American Academy of Neurology is the gold standard throughout the United States. I did cite that in my brief because the New Jersey Law Commission, thinking about revising it, went through a whole analysis of that, and I put it in my brief. They identified all the states that apply the AAN standards, including, they say, most of the hospitals apply that standard. But in any event, the standard, again, Your Honor, is clinical. What they are testing for is not whether or not the brain emanates electrical activity. Almost everything does. What they are testing for is a function. Do the eyes move? Is there a pain reflex?
Doesn't that go back to Part A of the statute? Essentially, it's Part A of the statute, irreversible cessation of circulatory or respiratory function. You had addressed that a little bit earlier, she was taken off artificial breathing for a period of time and couldn't breathe. Is that right?
Yeah. And again, the apnea test is the test to confirm unequivocally the existence of death. Because you take the equipment off, is the person going to draw a breath? If the person cannot draw a breath, that means that they're dead, basically. They cannot automatically. One of the brain functions is to draw a breath, and that didn't happen. I know that I'm out of time. There was a lot of questions. I did want to go back to what you said, Justice Pickering. Excuse me.
You're not out of time. You have 4 minutes.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You have 4 minutes.
I heard the bell ring, so I didn't know what that meant. But okay. In any event,
What you could help me with is this Harvard criteria, the AAN standards. What are those two different? And if so, is the difference the inclusion in the Harvard of an EEG, or is that just misunderstanding this?
No. One reason why the statute is drafted as broadly as it is because standards change over time.
Sure.
And that is why they want to be able to, they want the courts to be able to enable the doctors to bring everything up to date. Whatever is current is what they should be using. The Harvard criteria came about, I believe, around 1980 by the Harvard Medical School. And they had a bunch of standards in there. I believe maybe one of them was a EEG. The American Academy of Neurology published standards in 1995 and in 2006.
Has any court interpreting this Uniform Act applied the AAN standards that you're relying on, and if so, which courts?
The AAN standards.
Minus an EEG.
Minus the EEG, it's really a non sequitur because the EEG is not part of the AAN standards.
Right. Okay.
I can't cite it, but there were many, many cases cited to the court. Basically, what they are applying is the accepted medical standards. The only thing that I have cited to the court, it's hard to find a case. The reason why it's hard to find a case is because the AAN is not in the statute. It just says accepted medical standards. The court's role is to determine whether or not the standard is accepted. The standard adopted by the American Academy has been applied based upon the New Jersey study that I pointed out to you in at least three states all the time. It also states in that study that almost every hospital uses the American Academy of Neurology. It is preposterous, truly preposterous to say that the standards applied by the American Academy of Neurology are not accepted medical standards. The only testimony at trial, every doctor who testified at trial, including theirs, said that that is an accepted medical standard.
But do they demonstrate irreversible cessation of all brain function, including brainstem?
Yes, absolutely. That is the clinical test. I have a minute here. As I said, this statute was adopted by a collaboration of the American Bar Association, the American Medical Association, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, and the President's Commission on Ethical, Legal, and Medical Issues respecting the determination of death. And specifically as to EEG, and again, these are the drafters of the statute, say, in measuring functions, I emphasize, we're talking about functions now.
In measuring functions, physicians are not concerned with mere activity in cells or groups of cells. If such activity, metabolic, electrical, is not manifested in some way that has significance for the organism as a whole, the same is true of the cells of the heart and lungs. They too may continue to have metabolic and electrical activity after death has been diagnosed by cardiopulmonary standards. Tests that measure cellular activity are thus relevant to the determination of death only when they forecast whether missing functions may reappear. The court is getting confused in identifying an activity, cellular activity, with brain function. They are two different things. And last, with respect to that, that point...
Mr. Peterson, I have a question that I'd like to have answered. Having put all together what the exchange here is, I hear you saying, and this may be because I'm legally trained as opposed to medically trained, hence the reason that we use accepted medical standards. I get that. But I hear you saying that the reference in our statute talks to all cessation. If we test that against the apnea test, the AAN standard, the Harvard study, clinical observations, that means that EEG measurement, whether it's brainstem or not, and I recognize what you're talking about, function and electrodes, means nothing. Is that correct? The EEG itself informs absolutely none of these studies or the determination to be made with respect to death. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it is for the reasons that I've just identified in the study.
So why do we use it? So why do we use an EEG at all?
Say it again?
Why do we use an EEG at all?
We didn't. That's exactly the whole point. Why did we do it in the beginning? You mean because there was a record that they did an EEG?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Actually,
probably it was just part of a clinical examination of the patient. It was done, again, as somebody pointed out, within the first week, and it pointed out that there was some diffuse, and I mentioned the word diffuse for a reason, electrical activity in the brain. But I repeat, that is not a function. Electrical activity is not a function.
And it can never direct function once all these other criteria have been met. Is that correct?
That is correct. You're measuring brain functions.
So maybe why didn't we, and I'm sorry, Chief, may I ask one final follow-up?
Yes, let's wrap it up.
So then why isn't the matter of an EEG mentioned in our statute saying that it has no applicability to the determination of death?
I'm sorry, you're saying why
isn't... Doesn't our statute speak to the EEG informing nothing when it comes to determination of death?
Because, Your Honor, the drafters of this statute have recognized that it is not the function of the court in order to direct what and what is not an acceptable criteria for brain death. It is up to the medical practice. It is up to the medical standards.
Well,
what I'm telling you is the medical standards of the AAN.
Mr. Peterson, that may be the case, but there are over 25 cases that have interpreted the Uniform Act, and in every one of those cases, referring to the Harvard criteria, and admittedly between 1968 and 1984, that refer to the Harvard criteria, which requires, as a last test, an EEG test. I think the problem, as I see it from a legal standpoint, is given the substantial amount of legal cases interpreting the Uniform Act, and referring to the Harvard criteria going back decades, what courts, or are we going to be the first, that says that we should focus more on how we interpret the word function, and in assessing the word function, we should rely upon the medical expert testimony and not focus as much on all of this case law that supports the use of an EEG?
Because the statute says all functions of the entire brain, including his or her brainstem, a determination made under this section must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards. That's why. The accepted medical standards, Your Honor, whether it's intuitive to us or not. Some of us, I think, are thinking of watching the TV where you have the cardiopulmonary monitor that blips up and then it goes flat. That's not what we're talking about here. It is a mistake for this court, Your Honor. I tell you, it is a mistake for this court to make a ruling that now will engraft and read into the statute a requirement that an EEG be done, because that is not accepted medical standards. If it were, it would be part of the AAN, and it is not.
One real quick question, okay, I promise.
Justice,
as part of the AAN studies, weren't EEGs done in about 84% of those cases?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that, Your Honor. I apologize.
As part of the AAN studies that were done, weren't EEGs conducted in about 84% of those cases?
You know, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
I'm trying to get to the point to whether, the second part of the statute that refers to accepted medical standards. It was a significant part of what the AAN considered.
You know, I think I'm vaguely remembering that what they were trying to do, they did conduct a study of the AAN standards. And I think there were many studies, actually. One of the studies they're trying to determine, what they're principally trying to determine, is this a sufficient standard for determining death. One of those indicia that they may have looked at was EEG. I'm not entirely sure. Okay. But what I do remember from the study, and I think it's the same one you're thinking of, what I do remember from the study is, has anybody who has been declared brain dead under the AAN standard ever regained brain function? And the answer to that was not once in American history has that ever happened.
Okay.
Justice Hardesty, I have one more question. I'm sorry.
Okay, Justice Pickering.
The New Jersey report that you presented includes a statement that, and I'm quoting, the AAN guidelines, though arguably the guidelines upon which most hospitals and physicians rely, are not uniformly accepted in the national or even international medical community. In addition, no other state brain death statute specifically references the AAN guidelines or any other particular guidelines. That's the 2013 New Jersey Law Revision Commission final report. What say you to that?
Well, what I'm saying is I think what I've always said, and that is the statute is deliberately written not to pick the Harvard, not to pick the AAN, and that is because things change over time.
That is why the
statute says accepted medical standards.
Okay.
You're kind of reversing the burden of proof here. The burden is not on me to establish that AAN is not a medically accepted standard, because the unequivocal evidence in this case, including from their own doctor, is that it is unequivocally an accepted medical standard. The trial court did exactly what she's supposed to do. She said, is the AAN a medically accepted standard? Unequivocally, the answer is yes. Are the doctors qualified to make the determination? Did they apply the AAN test? Yes, yes, yes. Did she fail the test? Yes. And by the way, in conclusion, if I have a moment, because you asked I think you asked about the condition of the patient. I did not visit the patient today. I have in the past. Ms. Prupas did visit the patient today. The patient is deteriorating rapidly because this patient is dead. She's rapidly deteriorating. The trachea is now going to fall out of her throat because it's a necrotic body. The brain, even their doctor testified to this point, and that is, one of the tests that was done, the Doppler test, there's no blood flow or reduced blood flow to the brain. Doesn't that mean that there's necrosis in the brain right now? Probably. But we can't be sure. If you remember the Terry Schiavo case from Florida, you know, when they finally took her off the respirator, her brain was dead. Her brain was mush, basically, as a result of a lack of blood flow. I implore you, the statute is written such that the court is to apply accepted medical standards. AAN is an accepted medical standard. No one disputes that. Even their doctor said, if you check the box, every single criteria of the AAN standard for brain death was satisfied. That was their doctor that testified as to that. For this court now to inquire into whether or not the accepted medical standard should include an EEG or something like that is inviting. For the court to tread exactly where the drafters of the statute said, don't go there. The medical, accepted medical standards change over time. We do not want it laid in concrete. Otherwise, we'll be amending the statute every 2 years. You are now thinking about, if I understand what you're doing, and grafting a requirement of the statute. We can't have brain death unless we have a flat EEG. That's not what the statute says for a reason. I'm sorry to be so forceful.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. O'Meara, I'll add a minute to your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address your questions or your statements and Justice Perigary's in a second, but I want to address what Mr. Peterson just said about Aiden deteriorating. Of course he's going to deteriorate when they don't provide any medical treatment. And if you go back and look at the facts of this case, immediately we asked for a tracheotomy. And that was said by the doctors. Let's get that done. And what happened? They came back and said, no, this is in the administrator and doctor's hands. I'm not going to do it anymore. And that's important because if we had a tracheotomy or tracheostomy, she wouldn't be having these problems because when you get the tube down your throat, there's a balloon that increases and it pressures on your trachea. So think about all the time that she's sitting in there. She's laying in there. And every time she breathes, there's pressure. Of course it's going to deteriorate in her trachea because the medical reason is to have a tracheostomy, which they said, no, we're not going to give you after it was requested and was advised by two doctors from St. Mary's that that's what should happen. And it goes back to, I think, one of the justices asked about why we weren't able to move forward to Las Vegas. Well, we now know because of the admission by St. Mary's in their answer. They said, oh, great, you guys go out there, find someone that's going to take care of her. We've already determined her death. So guess what? What do they say? Petitioner was unable to make any such arrangements for the obvious reason that Aiden Helou is dead, and no facility is willing to undertake the care and treatment of a dead body. So while we are expediting this entire case, and we're going out there trying to find someone, because there was brain function to take care of Aiden. They knew there was no chance that we were going to be able to do it. None. No facility is willing to undertake and care. And we talk about their brief saying that doctors are supposed to make this decision. Well, go back into the record and you see one of the doctor, it's on page 595 or something, where he talks about there's death. But now we're going to go ahead and wait for the administrator and the lawyers to make that decision. It's not a part of the doctors. And that's what's different in this case. It has to be a part of what the doctors and the accepted medical standards. And it goes back to Justice Hardesty's comments about every single case in our jurisdiction in the United States says that when we look at brain death, we look at whether or not there is a function through the EEG, every single one of them. And it's not just from 1968 to 1983 for the Harvard study, but it's even after the ANA comes down, where we look at the Hawkins case in Atlanta, where they did multiple EEGs throughout the entire process of determining whether this individual was dead. Multiple. And why? Because that's the standard. That's the accepted medical standard, and St. Mary's knows it because they did it 3 times.
Go ahead.
I forgot your question, and I apologize. The whole purpose is to ensure that when we make this decision of life and death, we have all the technological advances and everything that we have in place. And just like the New Jersey case says, when you utilize an EEG, it better be flat. In Drabrick, which is the California case, it says, if he's not flat, he's not dead. So we should apply that, and it doesn't mean that there's a bright-line rule of EEGs must be performed. It just means that when you utilize the medical technology that we have today, and it determines and it cannot confirm brain death, as in all the cases show it does not until you have a flat-line EEG, we cannot go back and say that test is not applicable. So we ask the court again to return this back to the district court to say that the appropriate standards were not applied and that a determination of death was inappropriate, and that Aiden Hillo is not, in fact, dead. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you, Mr. O'Mara and Mr. Peterson. Thank you for your excellent arguments and briefs in the case. And I think the court clearly understands the sobering decisions that the medical folks have had to make, the lawyers have had to make, and the judges have had to make. We will do our best to act as promptly as we can. The case will stand submitted.